Welcome to Component 4, which is entitled Introduction to Information and Computer Science. This is specifically Unit 8, which has the name Security. In this unit, our objectives include gaining the abilities to list and describe common security concerns, describe safeguards against common security concerns, including firewalls, encryption, virus protection software and patterns, programming for security, and so on. Describe security concerns for wireless networks and how to address them. List security concerns and regulations that relate to healthcare applications. And finally, describe security safeguards used for healthcare applications. When you consider the threats and then the things that we need to do to protect data, something that we should keep in mind is that we want to determine immediately before we have any data on our network how we're going to protect the data. And how can we mitigate security issues? When we use the word mitigate, we mean to decrease the effect of something bad that might happen. In other words, something bad may happen eventually. Well, how can we make that bad thing have the minimal impact on our data and on our assets for the company? And so some of the things that we do are create a security policy. We authenticate users. We employ the use of firewalls. Install antivirus software on all devices, install and use a piece of hardware referred to as an intrusion protection system or an IPS. We encrypt communications and store data. And finally, we audit adherence to security policies. Most security policies contain provisions related to security definition. In other words, what is it? Enforcement. Which means how are we going to make people obey the rules that are listed in our policy. User access to the network, devices, software, and data. Password management. Email and internet use. Antivirus software use. Backup and recovery procedures. Intrusion detection. Auditing. And many others. We've talked quite a bit about authentication and authorization. But we've mentioned that users typically will enter their credentials in the form of a username and password. So authentication involves something that you know in that case, but authentication can also involve something that you have, such as a smart card or a badge, and then something that you are, for example, your fingerprint or a retinal scan or palm print and so on. So notice here that authentication is really made up of something that you know, something you have, and something that you are. We've already discussed one-factor authentication, we just didn't provide a name for it. And so one-factor authentication is really the simplest authentication process, and this is where the user enters their credentials, a username and password. With two-factor authentication, we still need a username and password, but then we need one of the other authentication types, such as a smart card or a fingerprint reader. With three-factor authentication, all three authentication types are used, and so this means that we would require the use of a username and password combination, and a smart card or badge, and some type of a biometric reader, like a fingerprint reader. Another thing that we can do to mitigate security issues is use a firewall in our network. A firewall is software, and it also could be hardware, that blocks unauthorized communications to and from a computer. Windows operating systems all provide what's known as the Windows firewall, and you should leave it on and not turn it off. Routers also provide basic firewall protection. It's built into their functionality. Most ISP routers act as firewalls, and so this means that if you have DSL or some type of an internet service that's always on, somebody from the internet will not be able to infiltrate your network and attack your computer because your ISP device will act as a firewall that will stop that communication from passing into your network. A firewall inspects each piece of communication and then permits or denies that traffic based on rules that are set up. For example, you will not be able to connect to your brother's PC to copy shared photos unless your brother's firewall is configured to allow that communication. Each piece of communication on a network is typically known as a packet. Windows Firewall and your ISP router, which, as I mentioned, is also a firewall, will adequately protect a home office. Larger networks, though, require more extensive protection through the use of a firewall device. For example, Cisco's ASA 5500 series adaptive security appliance provides firewall and many other protections. Its cost as of September 2010 is in the price range of approximately $2,500. And that's a firewall with a reasonable amount of functionality. More robust firewalls cost a lot more money. And so on this slide, we have a screenshot of the Windows 7 firewall. Starting from the middle top, notice the text. It says, help protect your computer with Windows Firewall. Windows Firewall can help prevent hackers or malicious software from gaining access to your computer through the internet or a network. And then notice the little green shield for the home or work, also known as private networks. And as we go down that list, it says the Windows Firewall state is on. Incoming connections. The setting is to block all connections to programs that are not on the list of allowed programs. And if we wanted to make a change, then notice in the left panel, we would click to allow a program or feature through the Windows Firewall. Now going back to the center where I was reading from, the active home or work network is referred to as My Network. And then the notification state that Windows Firewall is currently configured for is to notify me when Windows Firewall blocks a new program. Now for a public network, networks in public places such as airports or coffee shops, the Windows Firewall state is on. Incoming connections, the status is to block them. Active public networks, there are none. And the notification state is the same, to notify me when the firewall blocks a new program. Another thing that we can do to mitigate security issues is require all of our devices to have antivirus software installed. And so AV software detects and removes malware. It can also protect against adware and spyware being installed on your system. Now, AV software requires current virus pattern definitions. And this means that as new viruses and new attacks become known, the AV software vendor updates the ability of the software to catch and then quarantine bad traffic on your computer. And this will cost approximately $50 a year. AV software typically searches all of your computer files for what are referred to as virus signatures. In other words, viruses all have common things that they do, and the AV software is able to read files on your system and determine if it's more likely that that file is a virus or not. If the AV software finds what it thinks to be as a virus, then the AV software will quarantine the file and ask you if you agree. AV software monitors for malicious computer activity. For example, if a running program attempts to perform some odd action, the AV software will stop and quarantine that program. If you were running Microsoft Excel, for example, would you expect it to start searching in a folder for files, or would you expect it to communicate on the network to a website? The answer would typically be no. Common antivirus software vendors include Avast, AVG Free, Housecall, Kaspersky, McAfee, and Symantec. We can't really choose one over the other here, but what many of us recommend is doing a web search for antivirus software vendors ranking and then examining the current list. Every year, many computer magazines will rank the AV vendors, and then you can decide which one you would like to purchase and then install on your system. We would also add that if you have free virus protection software on your computer, that's what it is. It's pretty good, but it's free. It's more beneficial to pay for antivirus protection software and then have updated virus protection pattern files installed on your system automatically. This is the best type of protection that you can have. When you think about it, the cost of $50 or $60 a year is nothing compared to the pain that you would have to suffer through if you lost all of the data on your computer. In corporate or healthcare environments where security of data is paramount and it cannot be violated, we might employ a hardware device known as an intrusion protection system, or an IPS. It's very similar to how a firewall functions, but provides much more protection. In this case, the IPS monitors all network traffic for malicious activity. Think of what that means. That means that this device is going to examine every packet that is passing through the network and to determine if that packet has bad intent. And so the purpose of the IPS is to stop intrusions and then alert network administrators to the threat. And so here on the screen we have, as an example, the Cisco Secure Intrusion Detection System. And this is an enterprise scale, real time, in other words, it examines traffic as the traffic is happening, not from capturing the traffic and examining it later. So real time intrusion detection system designed to detect, report, and then even terminate unauthorized activity throughout a network. And the cost is minimal, it's about $700. Now, would you use something like this at home? No. But you would use it in a larger environment. Another mechanism at our disposal to improve our network security is something known as encryption. Anybody who has any knowledge of the Three Stooges knows that they used to communicate verbally using something referred to as Pig Latin. And this is where they would change around the letters of their words, thinking that nobody would be able to understand what they were saying, although everybody could. Well, encryption from the computer standpoint means that we make communication unreadable to unauthorized viewers. And this is all done electronically. It's not like we give somebody a key or some type of a mechanism to be able to understand this communication. And so encryption uses electronic private and public key sets. In other words, each piece of communication that's encrypted has a private and a public key associated with it. This means that if you encrypt a file on your computer, you possess what's known as the private key. And if you wanted somebody to be able to decrypt that communication, then in theory you would provide them with the public key, meaning that only those two keys would be able to communicate on this specific piece of communication. Another example is encrypting your email. And so you might encrypt an email that you send to your doctor. You encrypt it using your private key. And this is all done automatically for you through the installation of a program on your email client. So if you're running Outlook, you could install a private key in Outlook that would encrypt your email. And then you would send, and you would have to physically send to your doctor the public key so that they would be able to read it. All communication that was encrypted using your private key through your email client would be protected, and nobody else would be able to read it except for those that have your public key. And if you protect your private and public key set for that communication, then nobody would be able to actually read that communication except for you and your doctor. So a medical office might encrypt data using its private key, and then the patient decrypts data using the medical office's public key. Encryption keeps data confidential, and as I mentioned before, you should never share your private key. Let's look at encryption using an example that makes sense to most of us, because encryption is typically hard for students to understand, especially when we talk about encrypting communication from one server to another, or encrypting communication from a web browser to another web browser. But it's all basically the same. And so here we have a Microsoft Excel 2010 document open. And notice that we click the File menu, and then we clicked Protect Workbook. Notice that one of the entries in that list is to encrypt this workbook with a password. In other words, we're going to scramble the contents so that the only way that the contents could be readable is to have somebody enter our password and then open the workbook, which decrypts it. Any Microsoft Office file can be encrypted or password protected in this way. And so when we encrypt a workbook and then close it, let's say that we log out of our computer, and then my sister logs into the computer after me, and she sees that at the root of my C drive I have a workbook which is entitled Medical Information, and so she double-clicks it to open the file. When she double-clicks the encrypted document, the password dialog box, which is shown here at the top of the screen, opens. And so, it says that this book is protected, and it requires a password to open it. And so she just enters some guess, some word that she types in. She types the word password and clicks OK. Well, if that's not the password that I used to encrypt or to password protect the Excel document, she will see the window that shows below. And so it says, it's a warning, and it says the password you supplied is not correct. And it gives some suggestions as to how that might be remedied, assuming that the person has the correct password. Any file or folder on a Windows-based PC can be encrypted. To encrypt a folder, in this case, or a document, create a new folder or file, and then name it as you would like it to be named. Then, right-click it, and select Properties from the menu. And that opens up the new Properties dialog box as shown on the left side of your screen. Then, click Advanced. You'll notice that towards the middle lower right corner to open the Advanced Attributes window, and this is shown on the right side of your screen. Click Encrypt Contents to Secure Data. Do you see that checkbox that's near the bottom left corner? And then click OK to apply this setting to the folder that I have here on the screen. Subsequently, all files placed in this folder will be encrypted, and this means that files in this folder can only be viewed when you are logged into the computer with your username and password that were used to encrypt the folder. All other user accounts will receive an access is denied message or something similar when they try to open any file in the encrypted folder. Even with all of these mechanisms in place to protect our network and our data, we really have to determine whether or not people and departments are following the rules. And so we have to audit our security policy practices. And really, an audit tells us if we are doing what we said we would do. And so, if nurses are to log off nursing stations when they leave that station, is this being done? And so we may have to have somebody observe and then record. Is the database server kept up to date with critical updates? We would have to have somebody audit the database server's update records to determine when critical updates to the operating system or other software installed on the server were issued, and then when they were actually applied to the server. Is all access of medical records logged? Are backups being done regularly and stored according to what we said we would do in the security policy? For example, many organizations will back up throughout the day and then in the evening, and then order that the backup tapes should be stored in another building, for example at a bank or so on, or even in another part of the world. Do employees adhere to email policies? And so on. Additional steps that we can take to improve the security of our assets, and especially our data, include educating employees. Employees should be taught to never open unsolicited attachments. In other words, if you receive an email with an attachment, don't click it even once. Users should be taught to lock their screens when they're not sitting at their desk. And so if you get up to go get a drink of water, then you should press Ctrl-Alt-Delete, press Enter, which locks your computer from unauthorized use. Don't click on pop-up ads while surfing. These should never be clicked. Sometimes an ad will pop on the computer that says, click here to scan your computer, and then when you click anywhere in the window, including the red X at the top right corner, it installs adware, spyware, or even a virus on the computer. And then one of the other things that we can do is educate employees so that they report strange activity to network administrators. In other words, is something happening on the computer that we don't normally encounter? Did somebody call and ask me for my password when this is not normally our practice? Or even if it is our practice, we should put that in the security policy that that's unacceptable, and so on. And then, one of the things that we can do is if we create software within our organization and then install this software on our computers, is we create secure software applications. In other words, only authenticated and authorized use of our software is permitted. And then our software also contains rules so that if it's used, somebody can't later say or subsequently say that they didn't use the software. We may have a database program that allows users to enter patient information in a database. And then later we find out that that patient information is incorrect. Well, we might want to know who entered that data. Our software should prove beyond a doubt who entered that data. And it's not that we want to terminate somebody or chastise them. It might be a training issue. And so if we can determine who entered the wrong information and then why this was done, we might be able to stop that from happening in the future. Password policies usually revolve around the subject of password complexity. A complex password is usually at least 6 characters long and is made up of at least 1 uppercase character, 1 lowercase character, 1 number, and 1 special character. In some security courses, you might see it written that a complex password is 3 out of 4 of those items that are listed there, as long as the whole password is 6 characters long. In a very robust environment where password complexity is taken seriously, they might say that a complex password is at least 8 characters long and is made up of all of the items that I just mentioned, and they're listed in the slide notes for this slide. In addition, the password policy may state that passwords need to be changed on a regular scale of maybe 60 or 90 days, and that the password that you used last month can't be used again next month. And in addition to that, that password can't be used for at least 10 iterations of password changes or something along those lines. Our policy might also say that passwords should not be written down anywhere. Hackers and others know that if you want to find the password to a computer, the first thing that you do is you look around the screen for a sticky, and then you take that sticky, look at the front of it, and if nothing's written on the front of it that makes sense, you look on the back. They also know to get on their knees and look under the desk, to look in desk drawers on the sides of the drawers and put their hands on the top inside of the drawers and so on. They also know to look under the keyboard. They'll actually lift the keyboard and turn it over. So they will look all around. They know all the tricks that people use to try to write down and then hide their password. You should never do this in any environment where you need security. We could also implement a domain-based network environment. In a domain-based world, a server, which is a computer installed with special operating system software, manages users, devices, and policies. In fact, the server manages all objects that are part of the network. And the server determines that network assets can only be used by objects that are part of the domain that the server manages. You can think of a domain as you would a gated community, where the gate around the community represents a geographical location that's fixed, and it's also guarded. And so a server guards its domain, and it doesn't allow any other object to enter without permission. Another thing that you can do in a domain-based network environment is you restrict the number of network administrators that are permitted. Only those that need to be network administrators should be network administrators. When security professionals examine an environment and look for things that they can do to enhance security, they usually look for what's known as low-hanging fruit. In other words, what are some simple things that we can implement to improve the security of our data and our assets and so on? And so in our case, when we talk about data and our networking assets, physical security of assets means that we should first bolt our servers to some type of a device, like a wall or a floor or so on, in a locked room. In this locked room, we don't allow anybody to enter unless they have to have a reason, unless they have a reason to be in that room with that equipment. In fact, we would not allow anybody in our server room unless they slip their badge through the door device, and then this would be recorded, giving us an idea as to who was in there and then how long. All of our devices should be password protected at all times, and if somebody's not sitting in front of the device using it, it should be locked. In some environments, for example, a hospital setting, you may have a number of servers that are all running 24 hours a day. Let's say that we had 100 servers that were running. All of those servers would be password protected, and their screens would be locked. And we lock the screen by pressing Control-Alt-Delete and then hitting Enter. If a network administrator wanted to gain access to that device so that they could look at the desktop or use its, or administer the operating system and so on, they would use something known as remote desktop to access the server. And so then nobody would have physical access to the server unless they absolutely needed it. In addition, our servers and other devices should be UPS and then power surge protected at all times. And so this would protect the integrity of our data. Another thing that we can do is to validate all data that's entered into our databases. All database entries are validated before their storage in the database. And we do this because let's say that we have a database field and you are asked to enter a name. Well, most of us would think a name would be something like John or Jim or Kathy or Bob. But what would happen if somebody entered in an ampersand and a number and a space and a period? Would that cause the database to stop functioning as we would expect it? Because if that's the case, then a hacker might be able to gain control of the database and steal its data. And so in this case, we test for expected and unexpected field entries. And so if we expect somebody to enter a first, you know, a typical name, a character-based name in a database field, we should also test for folks who would enter something else. And then we should handle that. And so if we have a field on a form where we require somebody to enter their first name, and when they enter their first name and then press tab or press enter, we would capture that information and then test it to see if the information entered matches what we expect it to be. Then, if what was entered is invalid, for example, if a name has a number in it, it's probably invalid. And so if that was the case, we could clear the field, pop a message on the screen, and then ask the user to enter their information again, and if they continue to run into issues, then they would have to talk to a human being.